Case number 16-5236. Brett Steele, Appellant v. James Mattis, Secretary of Defense. Ms. Rucker for the Appellant, Mr. Fahrenroth for the Appellee.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Donna Rucker on behalf of Dr. Steele, who has filed this appeal because it is our belief that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment in this case and concluding that Dr. Steele had failed to establish or present evidence from which a reasonable jury could conclude or find that discrimination, age discrimination, had in fact occurred. And we assert this for three basic reasons. First, we believe that the trial court in this case particularly weighed the evidence, also made credibility determinations, and ignored evidence of pretext, and did not provide Dr. Steele with the ability to have the evidence reviewed in a light most favorable to him. And with respect to the particular evidence that put forth in this particular case, Dr. Steele has established or has asserted that he believes that when he came to NDU as a professor, that he was given the position as a placeholder. And he believes this because very soon after starting in the position, he received what he believed to be questions and concerns about his teaching style and skill. And although in the record it shows that he made whatever adjustments were requested of him, there was still this intent and determination.
He was a probationary employee, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so for that reason, he could have been fired for any reason, but not for an unlawful reason, right?
And that is correct. And our position
is
that...
Your claim is that the unlawful reason was he was fired because of his age.
That is correct.
And to establish that, you have to compare the way he was treated with others who were similarly situated, but benefited because of their age. Is that right?
Well, we do in establishing a prima facie case. In this particular case, the appellee came forward and indicated that it believed that the decision to terminate Dr. Steele, in fact, occurred because of budget cuts. Mm-hmm. And so with respect to articulating this proposal...
What I was getting at was you have to show that others were treated well because of their age, while he was treated poorly because of his age, right?
Well, that is what we've asserted in this record as well.
And so, how have you shown that?
So particularly with, let's use, for example, Professor Miller, who is a younger employee who, in fact, was at the university, also in a probationary period, and this decision which was made to release particular employees resulted in only two individuals who were faculty being released, and both of those individuals were over the age of 40. And with respect to Dr. Miller, who was allowed to remain, we believe the record evidence shows that he was not, in terms of his skills and abilities, an employee that, for those reasons, as asserted by the agency, should have been someone considered to remain.
Well, tell me about, I actually want to go back to the beginning in the prima facie case that was asserted here. And the fourth prong requires that you show that he was replaced by a substantially younger person.
Yes.
So the people that took over his job duties right after he was dismissed were 11 years older, 6 years younger, which isn't treated as substantially, and one was 10 years younger. So if two-thirds of them don't qualify as substantially younger, only one of them might have. And his permanent replacement was, I think, about the same age, 47.
Didn't hear the last part.
His permanent replacement was 47. So how did you even make out the fourth prong of the prima facie case here?
So with respect to looking at other individuals who were advantaged more favorably than Dr. Steele with respect to how they were treated. We are looking, in addition to the individuals whom the court has identified, the fact that very soon after Dr. Steele was allegedly released for budget reasons, the agency, in fact, hired two other individuals to work within
the same... But not to do his job.
Well, they were to work in within the same department as Dr. Steele was working.
But if the people that replaced him were not younger, by here we require substantially younger in this particular area, were not substantially younger. They just weren't. In fact, one was the same age. Why do we even bother looking out at other people? Doesn't that blow a hole in your prima facie case?
Well,
are you aware of a case, let me be more specific, where you weren't able to show the fourth prong of the prima facie case as to the plaintiff's particular position? It was replaced by someone of, I think, the same age. Wasn't he 47 when he was dismissed?
Well, we cannot, Your Honor, in our position at this particular point.
Are there cases where we then said, okay, even though you were replaced by someone the same age, we're going to start looking around at other people who are also teaching but teaching different things and see what happened there? Or do we look and say, look, you were replaced by someone who was just the same age as you, that's the end of the prima facie story?
Well, it only is the end of the prima facie story if that is consistent, we believe, with the record of what has been presented. So it is true and correct that these individuals who actually remained and began doing the work were individuals who were older.
The one who actually took his position was the same age.
They taught the course. It was a multi, several professors taught the same course during the evening and other times. What we are pointing out...
But there was a permanent replacement a year or so later.
They did have a permanent replacement.
Who was 47.
That is correct. Okay. But what we're trying to point out, Your Honor, what we did point out in this particular record is the fact that for those individuals who came forward subsequent to Dr. Steele's removal, if you look exclusively at what the university did after Dr. Steele was asked to leave, the record that we present deals with the issues of whether or not it was actually correct that Dr. Steele could not teach some of the courses that were going to come in later. So that is the position
that
we took.
Well, we only look at pretext. Pretext helps you, but you have to have a prima facie case for that to go with, right? If you haven't made out a prima facie case, pretext isn't going to get you past summary judgment. If you have made out a prima facie case, then pretext could get you past summary judgment under Reeves. So the question is, when you haven't made out a prima facie case because your replacements were not younger, relevantly younger, substantially younger as is required. In fact, your permanent replacement was exactly the same age, and one was 11 years older than you, then what does it matter if you show pretext that they didn't say the right reason?
Well, I do understand that, Your Honor, but when you look at Dr. Miller, for example, the individual that I was pointing out who is substantially younger, he is one of those individuals who was supposedly teaching the courses that Dr. Steele was supposed to teach.
Right. And another one was 11 years older.
That is correct.
So it looks like for at least temporarily his job was split to three people.
But the two people correct? Who were fired as faculty members were both over the age of 40. And what we point out in this record is there seemed to have been a pattern and a trend of getting rid of the older employees. Now, to the extent that they've retained one or two with respect to the example that
that pattern or trend rely upon your statistical calculations? Is that where you show that?
Well, it's from the employment records. It shows with respect to the retention.
Because there are lots of problems with the statistical calculations you
we're not relying very heavily on the statistical calculations that Dr. Steele offered, but we pointed out, I'm sorry, we pointed out simply because the records with respect to how and whom it is that they hire or retain tends to show this trend, we believe, with respect to retaining younger individuals and getting rid of individuals who are older.
Why don't you rely on the statistical calculations more than I'm...
Well, we do rely on it.
Why do you rely on it at all? I mean, it doesn't have any of the relevant confounders. Retirement, range of species, experience and skills, and it's a terribly flawed.
Well, we don't have to, in these particular individual cases, look very closely when we're talking about one particular individual, as we are in this case, being the victim of discrimination.
Let me ask you, Ms. Rucker, a really preliminary question. I was puzzled as to why it wasn't briefed in this case, the applicability of the Ford versus Mavis decision from the circuit, which points out that for federal employees, it's unlawful for age discrimination to be a factor. It doesn't have to be the cause.
That is correct. Only if you're looking for specific damages beyond.
Right.
Yes.
And I wondered whether that's because you're not pursuing that.
That is correct.
You're not.
That is, well, we are, in fact, pursuing an A factor. So we believe that both exist in this particular case, because if it's actually the but-for cause, it's clearly a factor as well, is how we were reading the record in terms of what we presented here. And again, what we pointed out and what we believe we pointed out in this particular case, the judge himself, in looking at this in the lower court, at the record at DA Deferred Appendix 88-5, specifically points out that he thinks the prima facie case is weak. And in that instance, he is acknowledging that there are some elements of what has been presented. I think it alludes to what you
were
saying.
I'm just asking you how it's present, how it's met here.
That's correct.
I think the district court was going, look, they've said their legitimate reason. I'm just going to say it's weak and move on because they presented a reason. I'm going to move to the next stage. But for your purposes, for summary judgment analysis, we go back and we look at what was shown at the prima facie case, and then we look at other things like the pretext that you're arguing.
That is
and
correct.
We put them together. But when I went to try to add them together, I couldn't understand how you met the fourth prong of your prima facie case, and I have to analyze the evidence here to see if you've got enough to get past summary judgment. So I think I'm going to ask you the question even if the district judge blew past it.
I do understand. I see that my time is up, Your Honor.
You can keep answering.
Thank you. So with respect to the position about it, when the court says, as the judge does in this particular case, that the prima facie element seems to be weak, with respect to Dr. Miller, he is specifically pointing out, the judge is specifically pointing out, that we have two individuals, Dr. Yuko, as well as Dr. Miller, who are coming on board. What we believe is significant and relevant with respect to those individuals is this determination that these individuals were not proper comparators with respect to whether or not there was a disadvantage, treatment that was disadvantaged to Dr. Steele versus these other individuals. That's the point that I wanted to offer. Thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Peter Fafnoth for the government. I agree with the questions that were being posed. I mean, as a threshold matter, the plaintiff never stated a prima facie case.
And where did you just state a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for firing him? You said you had to get rid of three people for budget reasons, but that doesn't explain why you fired him.
It's a process of elimination, Your Honor.
How did you state, what was your legitimate reason for getting rid of him?
Three spots had to be eliminated.
Yes, and you got to explain why you picked him
right.
rather than the other three
right.
people
and
that were left behind. And the reason was?
And the reason is that they couldn't get rid of people for whom funding had not been cut, so mm-hmm. that accounts for Dr. Uko. They did not get rid of Dr. Miller because Dr. Miller was a specialist in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which the Joint Chiefs had told NDU to focus upon. And they did not get rid of Dr. Parker, who was 59 years old, because he had skills that were likewise incredibly valuable to NDU, and this court should not try to look too deeply into NDU's assessment of what its teaching needs were at that time.
Why?
In any event,
why? Isn't that to determine whether something is legitimate and non-discriminatory? We have to look. I
because,
mean, the district court was wrong to say
of
we
course,
don't look.
Of course, you have an obligation to inquire into whether there was an unlawful basis and mm-hmm. a pretextual basis for removing someone. But at the same time, this court is not well positioned to evaluate, you know, particularly in the context of a higher educational institution.
Why
like
do you
this
say
one.
Particular? I get you're saying it, and the district court said it, and I can't for the life of me figure out why, when it comes to discrimination cases, that we assume or give any extra leash to those involved in education than we would to those involved in medical care, running the military itself, actually conducting wars, these types of things. But I don't understand where that comes from, and you're arguing for it, too.
Our position doesn't hinge upon that, Your Honor, but
right.
I do think that it is different, because professors are not interchangeable the way that, for instance, a surgeon might be. Of course, every surgeon might be a little bit better at this surgery than at that surgery, but ultimately, most faculty members at most educational institutions have a specific focus on a specific area, and they, an institution is entitled to...
Presumably that's why Dr. Steele was hired in the first place, though, right?
It was sort of a luxury more than...
What?
A luxury. You went after him. Yeah. You offered him one thing, and he turned it down.
He had a certain set of skills that was valuable, so he was hired, and you're then saying somehow later those skills weren't quite so valuable?
I'm not saying that those skills were not valuable. It was certainly valuable.
It's him and Parker. I understand your argument about UCO, the funding hadn't been cut.
Although I have a question about UCO.
Makes sense. And I understand your point about Miller, but I can't quite understand the distinction between Steele and Parker here.
Well, at the first point, the plaintiff, the appellant, says he can't really compare himself to Parker. So he certainly considers Parker to be at least his co-equal. They were both folks with impressive resumes.
Why was Parker kept and Steele fired? Why?
At the end of the day, if the question is simply Parker versus Steele, and I understand that to be where the court is going. Parker was had very high reviews, and as the record establishes, he, you know, if one is comparing 59-year-old Dr. Parker with 47-year-old Dr. Steele or 48-year-old Dr. Steele, Dr. Parker had shown himself to be even more valuable to the institution.
Was that ever communicated to Dr. Steele?
Not in a way that he was required to. First of all, he's a probationary employee, so you don't have to give them an explanation.
Well, you have to give a legitimate non-discriminatory reason.
Yes, and the legitimate non-discriminatory explanation provided through litigation, which is the point at which this becomes relevant, is that Dr. Parker had really thrived at the institution, and he was very
valuable.
But
then that's a disputed fact, because he says he had great reviews from students, and Steele doesn't, that they were all upset when he was fired. I'm talking about disputed facts. I have no idea what the true story is.
But Steele doesn't actually dispute that Dr. Parker was qualified to remain. So if the question
sure
is simply
he thinks that they were, Dr. Parker he can agree with that and think he's just as entitled to remain as well. That doesn't get you to a legitimate non-discriminatory distinction. And then as to, is Miller the Afghan studies one? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Miller, yes.
Right. And so, again, it seemed like Mr. Steele was chased, a great expert in his field, and was chased after enough that when he turned down North Carolina, came back after him again just 10 months early and said, okay, we'll let you, please come to D.C. or wherever this one was. And so what basis, other than the assertion that, well, we wanted the Afghanistan stuff, was there even for distinguishing between them?
Sorry, for distinguishing between
the subject matter. They taught different subject matters, but you were in, hot pursuit of Dr. Steele for what he taught just 10 months earlier. So I'm trying to understand.
He was teaching. He had a background in economics. He says he has a background in engineering and a background in history, and those are all relevant, and that's why he was initially recruited. But at the end of the day, a year in, the budget situation had changed, and they had to make some hard decisions. And they reasonably made the decision that, based upon the Joint Chief's directive, they were going to focus on Central and South Asia.
I have a couple of questions about the funding. One is, Dr. UCO, you said that his funding for his position was secure in the counterterrorism fellowship program. Is that right?
That's right.
There also was testimony, though, by Dr. Hanlon, that funding for the counterterrorism program was secure. So that I had thought that was an issue in dispute. It's page 625 of the joint appendix. She said funding for that was secure. So isn't that a kind of issue we can't just assume that that's undisputed?
I think I'm misunderstanding what you just said, because the point was that the counterterrorism funding, which provided for Dr. UCO, was secure, and I don't believe there's a dispute in the record. There's nothing other than just assertions to suggest that it was still in place.
So that's the funding for
UCO.
I thought there were two different pieces of testimony. One says it's not secure, and one says it is secure. I'll have to follow up.
The other question
about funding, though, is then quickly after this, you have two people that are brought on. So it was a very temporary funding problem, or it's just not really clear how, I mean, there seems like there was a lot of turnover in the short period of time, and during that period of turnover, the number of people over the age of 40 dropped precipitously, but there were a lot of people brought on.
First of all, Your Honor, it's a factual matter. Even the statistics, such as they are,
I think of it as sort of anecdotal evidence of numbers.
They actually show that people in their 40s and in their 50s, if you look at those 10-year periods, they actually increased between 2011 and 2014, based upon that very evidence. This is a point we made in our brief, and it's based upon the records that the appellant submitted. In any event, the people who were brought on around about the time that Dr. Steele was let go were people, again, who were focused on South and Central Asia, as opposed to the more generalist category of Dr. Steele. If the court has nothing further.
So I'm just trying to identify, because I didn't mean to confuse you about the counterterrorism program. What I'm thinking about is on page 625, where Dr. Hanlon says there were continual discussions with the funding organization. There was discussion about billets being reduced. The funding was also going to be reduced for that program at Fort Bragg, as well as for the program, the counterterrorism fellowship program. She says the funding was going to be reduced for that. So that was what made me think there was some amount of dispute about whether it was secure or whether it was actually in jeopardy.
The rest of the record, Your Honor, I think I see what you're referring to, but I also see two hyphens before that, and it seems like that was, it's, you know, I don't believe that this is a particularly clear statement. She doesn't finish the sentence. It seems that she was interrupted. In any event, she doesn't actually say that the counterterrorism fellowship funding was being reduced. She's talking about other billets that are being moved around and that are being reduced. And there is clear evidence in the record that the counterterrorism fellowship program that funded Dr. Uko was not being reduced.
But then she seems to say that Dr. Steele, his funding was tied to that program. So if it's secure, then he would, just as Dr. Uko, have a secure footing, or if it's not secure, then that doesn't distinguish.
I don't know what to read into the tied to that program.
Yeah, I don't either, because I'm just reading this record. But in terms of disputes, it just struck me that, you know.
Right. There's quite clear evidence in the record that there was a directive from on high at DOD that NDU had to get rid of 17 FTE positions on the research side, and they got rid of CISA's, or College of International Essay, a piece of that was going to be three positions, and they had to come up with three names.
And can you fill us in at all on why they were quite quickly hiring two new employees?
Because they had sought waivers earlier on, and that waiver would have, in fact, protected Dr. Steele, and so that's evidence against, you know, an animus against based upon age. And while that waiver was being sought, and around about the time that the Joint Chiefs had said, go out and really build up your Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central and South Asia focus, they started that hiring process, and funding specifically for those kinds of positions was located, given the Joint Chiefs' emphasis. But just because there were some hiring decisions made around the time that the completion of an earlier removal process in order to try and right-size the CISA generally, given the funding limitations that had come to light, just because those additional hiring roles were being made doesn't mean that they had to go back and undo decisions that had already basically been finalized, and we were simply waiting for the last day.
And just to, you know, sort of fill us in on the nature of this, are there kind of permanent faculty at CISA, or is it more people come through for stints of 3 years? And I mean, is there a lot of turnover or not?
I'm not an expert on CISA. What I've seen in the record indicates that people tend to be on three-year terms.
So it isn't like a typical college where people come and they stay for a big chunk or all of their career.
It's not a permanent faculty, I'm informed by agency counsel. But what I've seen on the record is the 3 years that are referenced in a number of places, that people have 3-year contracts, basically the first of which is a probationary period.
And do you have a position on Ford versus Mavis and whether, you know, you didn't argue that you met the, that age was not a factor, but I assume that you think it's covered by the position that you've taken, which is age was not part of it at all.
No, age wasn't a part of it. But I do think, actually, that in the context here, if you look at the complaint, she's seeking, or sorry, the, Ms. Dr. Steele is seeking back pay. And in light of that,
right.
But for
right.
is the standard.
What about the evidence that Dr. Villanos said, you know, isn't it great working with young people and those old people are so stubborn and difficult? That seems to me to be arguably evidence that, that could move a jury to...
But it's not relevant, Your Honor, because A, it's a stray remark. B,
well, that's a legal characterization. You just right. say, I don't want that to be
well,
relevant.
I was going to hang on. If she had said instead, I'm so glad we've been hiring the white people. Those black people are so impossible to deal with. What a fresh air to have more white people. Would you stand here and say it's a stray remark? Or would you say that's powerful stuff for a jury to consider?
I would say I would go on to provide the rest
would
of the
answers.
Would
you say
that
was a stray remark or not?
If she was a decision maker, I wouldn't. I
you
would
don't
have
to be the decision maker. There's cat's paw liability. So trying again, would you say it's a stray remark if it said the same thing about race rather than about age?
I would ask, is it around about the time that the decision was being made?
You would. You can't tell me whether you would still call it. Either it's a stray remark or not.
I would be very troubled by that kind of
exactly.
remark.
Exactly. So age is just less protected in your view? It's okay to just brush that off as a stray remark, but it's not okay to brush off other forms of discrimination? Is it a
well,
lesser
question,
form of discrimination?
I mean, there are, what is a stray remark under this court's jurisprudence is mm-hmm. largely in the eye of the beholding panel. There are a variety of...
Usually direct statements about, I don't want to work with that protected class. I'd rather work with people outside that protected class.
That's not the record here, though. I mean, the record isn't I don't want to work with people of the protected class.
I'm so much happier to be working with people outside the protected class. Those in the protected class are cantankerous and difficult to deal with. What was said about race or about women? During the time of his 10 months tenure here?
There are other factors that go in as well to the fact that she had just played a role in bringing on mm-hmm. this particular individual.
Right.
And
no,
that might be that
you have other arguments. My only point is your characterization of it as a stray remark, which, to be fair, I think was a district court's characterization. But that's my concern.
And what weight do you place on the fact that she was not involved in the termination decision?
I place weight on that. I mean, the fact is she was a head of a department, but she was not in a decision-making role. I mean, she may have been a fly on the wall in a meeting where she talked about how Dr. Steele was doing.
Where's your record for fly on the wall? She said, yeah,
she said
I
she
had
played
input,
a role.
I was
she said
involved.
She was there and yeah. she provided input.
And she was a direct supervisor, so if I were the head honcho, I think that people whose input would be the most important to me would be the people who are directly supervising the individual, no?
But at the end of the day, also, as I explained earlier, I think it's really the process of elimination approach that gets you to Dr. Steele has to go, because the Bucco and Miller are both really essential to the programmatic needs of the program, and Dr. Miller,
like a disputed fact, whether theirs was more essential than the others. Originally it was just budget cuts, but that's not legitimate non-discriminatory because that doesn't narrow it down. So now it seems to be budget cuts made us decide that he's less qualified, and then that seems to sound more like
Your
the type
Honor,
of thing he's disputing.
There is in the record the letter at page DA 780 and 781 from 30th of August 2011 that provides that explains the entire removal process and the entire analysis of Dr. Steele and his role at CISA.
Yeah, but on 745 we have Villanos. I was involved.
Right.
Not necessarily
I'm
a decision, but yes,
involved,
in discussions of issues that may be connected. And then she talks about we're having these
fly on the wall is not the right characterization. You're right.
It sounds to me like the supervisor in Staub versus Proctor Hospital, which was the cat's paw case in the Supreme Court. It was the direct supervisor who didn't make the decision, but fed information to the decision maker. And that was held to be sufficient. And so what I'm asking is why not fly on the wall, involved, yes, but not the decision maker, and making comments that are directly about preference for working with people outside the protected class, why those two together don't add up to a ground on which a jury could or could not find a cat's paw form of liability here.
I'd also note that as we stated in our brief, cat's paw was not argued in this fashion in the district court, so it's been waived.
What do you mean by has to be argued in this fashion? Don't they just have to come forward with summary judgment evidence that from which a jury could infer discrimination? And is there any law of this circuit that says you have to specifically have a distinct claim about cat's paw liability? The claim is discrimination here. This is just one form of proof in it. Where do you have to... Is there any authority that says you have to do any more than what they did?
The general rule is that we want arguments to be adjudicated in the district court first so that it facilitates appellate review. And
She pointed to Bolanos' assessment that she was part of the decision-making. It seems
and
like
she made
if
these
you
terrible
use
comments.
The term cat's paw, that can't be the basis. No, I mean, just to say, here's somebody, here's her role, she was in the meetings, you know, I'm not disputing that she wasn't the ultimate decision-maker. There's nothing surprising about that presentation from the perspective of either the government or the district court, is there, in terms of, oh, that's cat's paw, I didn't know?
No. If the court has something further, I'd ask that the case be affirmed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Recker, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Wanted to address, Your Honor, with respect to the issue of what was elicited from counsel about the reason. And it appears to be correct that the reason being offered as to the distinction between Dr. Steele has to do with this alleged belief that funding was not available. I think the record is clear that at the deferred appendix at 625, there is this discussion with respect to the counterterrorism funding being cut as well, and specifically with the Fort Bragg billet, which is what Dr. Steele has been told he's working under. So to the extent that that is correct, then it does create a question, we believe, as to what is actually happening here, and a reasonable jury could conclude that this is offered as pretext.
Can I ask you just... I'm just going to tell you up front the one thing that I'm having trouble getting past, and that is he was hired and fired by essentially the same people, Hanlon.
And
he was hired at 47.
Correct.
And just 10 months later, so now he's 47 in 10 months or something like that, fired by them, but replaced by people who were not substantially younger. So could a reasonable jury find age discrimination there?
We believe yes, Your Honor, and here's why. With respect to the fact that he was both hired and fired in a very short period of time, we have to look at the totality of the record and the evidence in this case. And from the beginning, we've always asserted that Dr. Steele was brought there as a placeholder. The record is very clear that...
I don't understand what that's got to do with age discrimination.
If I may continue. Mm-hmm. The record is very clear that if Dr. Steele's position had not, in fact, been filled, that the university would have lost the opportunity to have that particular position in its next budget. We also see then individuals who had not particularly had the opportunity to complete their theses coming on board, not really being as qualified in terms of professors with PhD in place, teaching experience teaching, for example, military individuals or teaching at a military university. And so with respect to the issue of whether or not this was, I believe, and we believe, Your Honor, calculated in terms of the reason, I think that it very much diminishes this issue of I hired him and then a few months later I'm firing him. I believe age was actually the motivating factor. There was never a genuine intent.
So you think placeholder means age?
Well, I'm saying in this case they held him and his age was a reason why he was not considered a good fit. And as you'll know from this record, he is repeatedly referred to as not being a good fit, and we are speaking in that way. The last point that I wanted to make with respect to this record is that with respect to the decision about OCO, it is correct that this individual was coming in to teach particular programs in counterintelligence, but we cannot overlook the fact that with this particular record, it shows that Dr. Bell, when he was questioned, acknowledged that Dr. Steele had teachings, and this record shows that Dr. Steele taught with respect to the regions, both in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and in the South Asia region as well. This was information that Dr. Steele provided to Colonel Bell to show him why he was able and allowed to work in these particular departments.
Where's the joint appendix at for that?
Your indulgence.
You don't have it handy. You could
certainly. I do. I believe I have it here. Not to hold you up, Your Honor, I will provide that. It's
okay,
a particular point in the record where Dr. Bell acknowledges that he did not read Dr. Steele's file. So we submit that that is further evidence that in making these alleged decisions that Dr. Uka was more an appropriate person because of the teachings in Afghanistan and South Asia. Again, subjects to pretext because there is just no reasonable juror could conclude that you're simply saying that as pretext to mask the actual discrimination in this case. And with that, I would ask that this court, based on the evidence in this record and the arguments presented today, remand this matter to proceed and go forward with trial. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. Okay.